Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. Coming up later in the program, a Hanover woman who left her career in education to start an organization to help veterans. But up front, those living with a physical and/or cognitive disability are more likely to die if that person contracts COVID-19 than someone in the general population. In fact, a study from Britain found someone with Down syndrome is four times more likely to die if they get the virus, and 10 times more likely to be hospitalized. You haven't heard much about it, though, have you? Our guest today wants you to know that those living with disabilities are vulnerable, just like older people or African Americans or Latinos. Joining us on today's program is Dr. Dennis Downey. He's chair of the Public Interest Law Center of Philadelphia's Disability Policy Circle, author of the book Pennhurst and the Struggle for Disability Rights, and professor emeritus of history at Millersville University. Dr. Downey, welcome to the program. Why haven't we heard about those living with disabilities and the challenges that they face during this pandemic?
Well, good morning, Scott. It's a great question, and I don't have an easy answer for it. Certainly in the early days of the pandemic, there was so much attention being given to nursing homes and the real crisis in nursing homes as a feature of congregate care. And there was just a steep learning curve that had to be overcome. But I think that from the very beginning, the division of responsibilities within both state and federal government and at the local level sort of marginalized different groups. We're aware that racial and income disparities in health care and access to treatment, but very little attention was given to folks living with disabilities. And we're talking about somewhere on the order of 24 to 25% of Pennsylvania's population, in parts of Pennsylvania. So it's a good question why we haven't heard more. And ITF did some important early reporting, but by and large, this fell off the radar screen, or maybe never made it onto the radar screen, one might say.
Well, okay, you say that you don't know why, but do you have theories? I mean, do you have an opinion on why it hasn't gotten more attention?
Well, I do. I think that just given the structure of state public health in Pennsylvania and in many other states, we have the Department of Health, which was responsible for nursing homes. And we have the Department of Human Services and ODP, which was responsible for group homes and other kinds of in-home care for folks with disabilities. And there's a certain bifurcation there that leads to inefficiency. I also think that people with disabilities are oftentimes simply not just marginalized, but they're ignored in public policy debates. And they're sort of the last voice invited to the conversation. And I think that in part is what motivated me to suggest in the editorial that we need to be more proactive and aware of the really significant issues here affecting all Pennsylvanians, but particularly folks who live with a cognitive or developmental disability.
The editorial referring to, you wrote an op-ed for LNP in Lancaster talking about this very issue. In that editorial, you mentioned that you placed a phone call to the Department of Health, the State Department of Health, and from what you described, you did not get a very satisfactory answer.
I did not. This was early in the pandemic. It was probably early March, just as we were getting a sense as to the crisis in nursing home care, and due reason for it. But I called the Department of Health to ask why there wasn't more being said, more information being given out about group homes, other congregate settings, and folks with disabilities who live at home, who are the larger part of the population. Some of this, in a sense, was personal. We have a son with multiple disabilities, and from his experience, it got me thinking why there wasn't more public attention being given, why there wasn't more information and data being let out about group homes, and as opposed to what we were learning about nursing homes. And so I was sort of shifted from person to person, and as I explained in the op-ed, eventually was connected to a case manager here in Lancaster County. And the very quick and unsatisfactory reply was, well, we have nothing to do with group homes. And in terms of the division of administrative responsibility, that in part is true, but we're also in the midst of a public health crisis, a pandemic. And it seemed to me that there ought to be greater attention being given by the Department of Health in its briefings and also in its collaboration with the Department of Human Services and ODP. There ought to be a greater public response and awareness. And, you know, we still do not have accurate and complete information being shared with the public regarding rates of infection and hospitalization and other things for folks who live with a cognitive, intellectual, or oftentimes a physical disability of some kind.
What you described there, it sounds like the response you got was, hey, not my job. Did that person at least try to direct you to a place where you could get a satisfactory answer?
They did not. Now, I was aware of the Office of Developmental Programs and what they do in terms of licensing and monitoring group homes. And so I pursued information down a different path and eventually was connected to the website MyODP, which I think the general public probably is not aware of, but there were a lot of postings regarding directives and standards for care in group homes placed there. But so much of this was trying to catch up with events and to define protocols, not only for hygiene and health within group homes, but also the whole pattern of visiting. And there's such a parallel to what was being done with nursing homes, but there was no public recognition that we had a parallel crisis in group homes and then other congregate settings. So it was really through contacts that I have and then being connected to my ODP that I began to piece together information, but still, there was not hard data being given out. And Pennsylvania has a policy of self-reporting as opposed to mandatory reporting. And sometimes that creates holes that information slips through. And I think that's a general concern, as well as a particular concern in the time of COVID.
Dr. Downey, it almost seems like those with the loudest voices are the ones that are heard. Now, granted, you know, to be fair, back in March of last year, everyone was, I don't want to say in panic mode, but it was pretty chaotic at that time. We've learned so much as we've gone over the past year. And we're still learning. I mean, to me, it is amazing how much we learn in just a short amount of time from, you know, week to week or month to month. But That being said, it seems as though those who have the loudest voices have gotten the most attention during this pandemic, and rightfully so, when we're talking about nursing homes, when we're talking about minorities that have not have the had the access to healthcare. But when it comes to those who are living with disabilities, people like you are often the spokespeople for them and the advocates for them. Just doesn't seem like there are voices that are loud enough advocating for disability, those living with disabilities, as compared to maybe some other groups of people. Would you agree with that?
I would, Scott, with a couple of observations or provisos. There are very strong advocacy groups in the state, certainly the ARC of Pennsylvania and the local chapters. PAR, which is an advocacy group in Harrisburg, and is really devoted to direct support workers, personnel. There are some strong voices, but there is the absence of a kind of public voice in some ways. And you're right about whoever yells the loudest, but also whoever has the most influence and is invited to the table in discussions of public policy development. They are often the ones who are heard. And I think in the history of public advocacy, people with cognitive or an intellectual developmental disability oftentimes are the last invited to the table. Now, certainly with autism, there are several powerful national organizations, but you still don't hear a lot. And my effort in the op-ed was to cast Lancaster's particular debate over a county public health department in this broader context of public policy concern regarding health and safety, and to say, let's not forget about, but more than that, let's include people with disabilities who are, our friends, our neighbors, our family members, who oftentimes they're alone in a crowd, in the midst of neighborhoods and public settings. They are very much set apart. It's not the old institutional model, but it's still, there's a profound sense of social isolation that sometimes comes along with it. So my point was, for public health issues, but also for the particular issue of COVID, these citizens deserve a voice, a place at the table. These citizens deserve to have their public health concerns and their battles with COVID recorded and addressed. Well, and that was the point of the op-ed.
And I think something you just said, citizens. These are citizens of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. And just like 13 million other people, or anyone in this state, just what you said, that deserve to be heard. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Our guest during this portion of the program is Dr. Dennis Downey. He's chair of the Public Interest Law Center of Philadelphia's Disability Policy Circle, author of the book Pennhurst and the Struggle for Disability Rights, and professor emeritus of history at Millersville University. We're talking about those living with disabilities and what they have faced during the pandemic over the past year plus. If you have a question or comment, maybe an experience, a story to tell, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So, Dr. Downey, during this pandemic, those living with a disability, many of those living with disabilities are immunocompromised. Yes. What do we know about how they are more likely to, I mentioned this in the introduction, but what do we know about how more likely they are to suffer the serious consequences of COVID-19 and maybe even die?
Well, I think that there's a lot of data, a lot of information, both from Europe and the United States, the various medical publications, research institutes like Yale and Hopkins and Penn, and a wonderful resource that's open to the public, website called Disability Scoop, that has laid a lot of the information out there. We know that anyone, whether you have a diagnosis or an obvious disability or not, anyone with any kind of compromised autoimmune system is more vulnerable to virus and infection and an inability to fight off that infection, that virus. It's true for me. It's true for a lot of folks in the aging baby boomer population, but particularly for people with disabilities. Whether it's a physical or a cognitive disability, they oftentimes have compromised hearts, lungs. They have other comorbidities, if you like. So the risk of getting an infection intensifies, and because they're unable to produce the antibodies and they're unable to fight it off the way a younger, healthier, I hesitate to use the word, but more typical person might. And so if you're compromised and you are exposed to COVID, and it's true for nursing homes and a lot of other places, prisons as an example, the chances of not only getting infected, but suffering debilitating effects to the respiratory system, to your heart, your lungs, to your autoimmune system, just intensify. And then the possibilities, even if you don't suffer the extremes of symptoms, that you can pass it on to somebody else. And this idea of community spread and spread within these facilities and institutions. I mean, it's a crisis in prisons now. It's certainly we're well aware of folks in nursing homes and what they've been going through. And it seemed to me that we needed to pay more attention to what was going on in group homes, but also for the 60% of Pennsylvanians who live at home with a cognitive or physical disability. We need to be more aware of their health and safety, which is, after all, a matter of public health. And Lancaster's involved in this great debate about whether we ought to have a county public health department. And that's really what prompted me to write the piece.
Mm-hmm. We have a question. It's kind of a follow-up from one you addressed earlier. Lindsay asked, knowing that those with developmental or intellectual disabilities are immunocompromised in some way, the same way that older people are, why wasn't this data made public? And I guess Lindsay's just asking the same question that I ask, but a little bit different, bringing some context to it, that we did hear about some of those more vulnerable populations, but the part that was left out with not getting this data on those living with disabilities is just what you explained, is that many, if not most, are immunocompromised.
Yes, and I think that it's a very good question. It's one that requires a certain review of protocols within state government. There's a proposal right now to merge the Department of Health and the Department of Human Services, and there are huge issues behind that simple idea of merger, but one of which is what data will be shared. And while Pennsylvania has a policy of self-reporting and non-disclosure in terms of some information about group homes. And it seems to me, and it seemed to the Inspector General of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, that that should change, that it should be mandatory reporting, and there should be a more public disclosure of information. That hasn't happened. So that's a matter of state policy review, I think.
You know, I can't help thinking, Dr. Downey, when you're talking about, you know, how those living with disabilities are immunocompromised and could be more susceptible to the COVID-19 virus, that many, if not most, of those living with disabilities have had to be sheltered even more and taken out of their routines. I'm certain that's the case.
Absolutely.
But what has that done?
It is creating a tremendous social void for these people. The inability to be out in the community, the inability to attend to routine tasks, usually, you know, accompanied by someone, an aide and whatnot, it has really shrunken or narrowed the scope of social life to their residents. And it's beginning to change now. It's beginning to open up a bit. But it really has had a profound effect on the social experience of people with disabilities. And I think that for folks who thrive by routine, having the predictable and the expected and the normal routines that structure their everyday lives, by having those taken away, does tremendous, or it has done tremendous damage in some respects. And so the folks with disabilities, as much or more than other people whose lives have been narrowed by the experience of the COVID pandemic, they need just as much as anybody or more a return to routine, a return to activity. Watching TV 10 hours a day is not a healthy lifestyle. Mm. And it's tough.
I mean, what you're describing is a setback for many, and a year lost for many people. What does that mean going forward? And I don't just want to say in their development, maybe for young people in their development, but what does losing that year of socialization, losing that year of routine, what does it mean to them?
Well, it means the loss of their own experience of a kind of everyday normalcy and routine. And that has mental health, that has emotional and behavioral consequences of its own. And so the quicker we can return to, for folks who thrive on routine and structure, the quicker we can return to that, the better off they will be, not only in terms of just being busy. Everybody needs a place to go, I say. But also in terms of their own mental health, it has further compromised what is sometimes already a fragile kind of human experience. And the sense of isolation is profound. Folks were not able to come in and visit. In our experience, there were months we couldn't see our son. And it's understandable. But he couldn't go out. People couldn't come in. That sense of social isolation. And my co-author on the Pennhurst book, Jim Conroy, is beginning a big study about that very issue and what has happened as a result of this experience of social isolation.
Let's take a phone call from Amanda. Amanda, you're on Smart Talk.
Good morning, Scott.
Good morning.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I'm calling from Lycoming County. I myself have a disability, and during COVID, I discovered the Roads to Freedom Centers for Independent Living in my county.
Yes.
They not only provided services for people with disabilities, but they also provide transition living services. So they're actually helping families get their nursing home resident family member out of the group living situation, living independently in their own homes, their own apartments, their own accessible places with round-the-clock care, and they're actually lowering medical costs and Medicare costs for these services. So it's, I just wanted to share the resources of the Centers for Independent Living.
So
for, you know, people in rehabilitation as well.
So Amanda, I'm curious that they're even providing those services during the pandemic?
Yes, they were providing those services during the pandemic. They did receive very little COVID funds to help, but their transition services are something they've always offered. But during the pandemic and COVID, that was so much more important. And they were actually diverting a lot of funds to transition services to get people out of nursing homes, to get them safe from the pandemic. Here in Lycoming County, our nursing homes were hit really hard, really early.
So. Hey, Amanda, thank you very much for your call. Dennis,
if I can comment.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah, I think the Centers for Independent Living are a wonderful network of supports, and they really are a frontline kind of advocacy group. This, by and large, that's transition out of nursing homes into independent living. And it's a little bit of a different phenomenon often for group homes, particularly where you may or may not have parents or siblings who are available. And so I think the experiences are different, but the point that the caller made is a very important one. And the need to have resources available. And folks need to know where to turn. And here's where advocacy can help. But the transition out of nursing homes, which was the priority, is different than the transition out of and the careful monitoring of group homes. And we forget about the large population that lives at home with a cognitive, an intellectual or physical disability. And if you have staff that is, you know, moving back and forth and in and out, as we've seen the possibilities of bringing the virus in and transmitting it from one place to another, is very real.
And one thing that I think we should point out is that the advocacy groups, those who have worked with people living with disabilities or provided some services, it's not like they've gone away during the pandemic, but how have they adapted?
It's very difficult. Financially, many of them have suffered a great hit. Because the revenue stream is not what it was. Now, for a lot of folks who are in congregate settings, they're in group homes, they receive what's called a waiver, and that is a combination of federal and state funding. And I'll give a shout out to Governor Wolf, who's been trying to increase the dollars devoted to waivers, but it is a it's a means to pay for residential and other services. And I think that Senator Casey has several bills that he is co-sponsoring right now to increase the home and community-based services. I got caught up there, Scott. I'm sorry.
We're just talking about how the organizations have adapted.
Yeah, I think that in some respects, it's been a real challenge, not only financially, but also in terms of staffing. And you have too few staff and too many needs, and particularly if there is an outbreak in the home, people have to be quarantined. And so staff are moving back and forth, and the chances of their coming down with the virus are very real, and then they can transmit. And so there's what has always been a shortage of staffing for direct support workers is now intensified in the time of COVID. So you have the potential for people in group homes to become ill themselves and need extraordinary care. And then you have a declining number of staff people. And it's there's no doubt it's very difficult to manage. And providers have really had to struggle and to sort of reinvent their operations, even as they live with the new guidelines and criteria that are defined by ODP and the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services. You know, one of the things that has been lost is direct monitoring of facilities as support workers and others, case workers have been unable to go in and do the actual physical monitoring. So there are just layers of changes that providers and residents have had to deal with. And so that I'm sure they, as much as anybody, waiting for a return to more normal practices.
Dennis, everyone is different. Everyone living with a disability is different.
Yes.
But those with an intellectual disability or a cognitive disability, has there been an issue of those people understanding what's going on, that why they can't, why they're out of their routine, why they can't have visitors, why they can't socialize, that we're in a different situation? I would think that would be quite a challenge.
Oh, I think you're absolutely right. And, you know, we have to say there are degrees of disability, whether it's an intellectual disability or physical disability. But for some folks, on one level, they understand it, but they're powerless to sort of come up with an alternative routine or way of daily living. They need assistance in that. Other folks, like our son, really wouldn't comprehend all that's going on and why his volunteer and work program and why his community outings were cut short. Now they're opening back up again slowly. So, you know, it's not one size fits all, but there are degrees of understanding. But this is where self-advocates, people with disabilities themselves, are such an important voice. So they can, to use the phrase, speak for themselves and have them included in these policy debates, and as well as the advocacy organizations that are very familiar with it. And parents have to be listened to, and they have to be consulted. And that's reimagining the whole nature of public health, really, in Lancaster County and elsewhere.
We had a question from James, who's a student at Millersville, and wanted to know if should group homes make it mandatory for staff and clients to receive the COVID-19 vaccine?
Well, you know, that's a great question. And my answer as a parent is absolutely. However, there are any number of contingent factors that may not make that possible. As a matter of, you know, conscience, as a matter of cost, it may not be possible. But I would wish that providers would link up with local advocacy organizations to assure that the direct support workers are vaccinated and vaccinated at no cost to themselves. This is a public health issue, and it's a critical issue. So, but my response as a parent and as someone who's thought about all of this is that, yes, not only do the residents need to be vaccinated, but anybody who is providing direct care, and it's really medical care oftentimes, even if they don't have a medical degree, they should be vaccinated, not only to protect themselves, but to protect others.
Dr. Dennis Downey, thank you very much for being with us today, and thank you for your advocacy, bringing this to the public's attention. And hopefully just our time on the air today will make more people aware and ask questions about those living with disabilities. Dr. Downey, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Scott, very much.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar.
For a deeper look at the changing tide of healthcare, check out WITF's Transforming Health at transforminghealth.org, a partnership of WITF, WellSpan Health, and Capital Blue Cross.
Many people champion a cause, but most do it outside of work, or maybe even for a living. But Christy Lucas of Hanover took a different path. Ms. Lucas was a school principal and former teacher who left her career in education to devote full time to an organization whose mission was to meet the current needs and future challenges of military families, predominantly in rural areas. It's called Roots for Boots, and we're joined by its CEO, which has kind of a different meaning. Christy Lucas joining us today. Ms. Lucas, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So before we get into how you made this transition from an educator, longtime educator, to starting your own organization, tell me about Roots for Boots. What does Roots for Boots do?
Sure. Well, we're a grassroots organization. We are 100% volunteer and 100% funded by the local community. And basically what we do is work to meet whatever need or challenge a veteran, active duty, or military family would have. And we try to get people in the area to use their gifts, talents, and resources to help us. And we consider that your way of serving your country.
Now, I have to say that, you know, one of the things that sets Roots for Boots apart is that, you know, there are many people who get together, and I'm glad they do, that provide care packages to those who are deployed overseas, especially at holiday times, you know, sending cards or sending snacks or food or different things like that. But Roots for Boots, I mean, you do some things that I don't know. I would think can be costly, for example, but also have a profound effect on the lives of some individual veterans or military families. Give us some examples, if you will.
Sure. Well, we provide anything from rent, utilities, auto repairs, home repairs, all the way up to those all-terrain action track chairs. And those are considered a luxury by the VA. So they will not provide them, and they start probably around $15,000 and go up from there. But for our veterans who have issues with mobility and cannot get outside to hunt or fish or do anything like that, they are life-changing. And those track chairs are probably my favorite thing to get for our veterans, because you see firsthand the transformation. Just getting them out into the great outdoors is just, it's an amazing transformation. And we're getting ready to launch a campaign for another one for a veteran who is partially paralyzed from a stroke. And he's been in a wheelchair for 15 years and he's only 45 years old. And he's been trapped in his house. That's how he described it. I'm trapped in my house. And he said a track chair would change my life like you couldn't even imagine. And just to be able to restore that independence and mobility for them, there's no price tag for that.
Well, speaking of price tags, unfortunately, those track chairs do have price tags. What does one cost?
They start around $15,000 and they go up from there. So the one we're trying to secure for this veteran, it's going to actually stand him up as well. And for those that aren't familiar with the track chairs, they have tracks on them. So they're able to go over any type of terrain. They have a swivel arm on them for a firearm for hunting. They have a fishing pole attachment. They can ride over logs, sand, whatever. If you're a hunter, they can pull the deer out of the woods for you. So they really truly are life changing. And for the one that we need for this veteran, it's actually going to stand him up as well. So his is over $20,000. But like I said, even they come with a hefty price tag. They are life changing.
You mentioned you talk a lot about hunting and fishing and getting into mm-hmm. the outdoors. As I mentioned in the introduction, that your organization, Roots for Boots, works predominantly with those veterans or in the military in rural areas. Why rural yes. areas?
That's where the need is, and that's what I found just before I left the school. I was trying to find a veterans organization that I could volunteer for, and I couldn't find one. And it's mostly because we're in rural areas, and that's where a lot of our veterans live, are in rural areas. So I found that need, and through Roots for Boots, I think it was something that the community was actually looking for.
And you also describe Roots for Boots as a grassroots organization. And, you know, something you just talked about with this particular veteran who needs a track chair that costs $20,000. You know, many organizations, when we hear about them working to try to provide some kind of assistance to, you know, whoever their clients are, you know, you're talking about millions of dollars. But with your grassroots organization, you're in a fundraiser just to raise $20,000 at this point, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's correct. And we have a very generous community. And I think when I was at the school, that time there was priceless to me because I pretty much met everyone I knew who I needed to start the nonprofit. I met attorneys, I met accountants, I met marketing people. I learned how to run a board. So that time there was actually, I think, preparing me for what became Roots for Boots.
All right. So let's talk about that transition. As I said, there are many people who are very passionate about different causes and helping other people, but there are not many of them who leave their careers and start an organization that is made up of volunteers. What motivated you to do that?
Well, I was a teacher for 14 years and I was a principal for 3. And the principal job was kind of a surprise. I didn't really plan on that one. But anybody who knows me knows I'm a woman of great faith. And I just put God in charge. He's the CEO. I'm the chief enthusiasm officer. And at the end of my contract, which was 3 years, I just felt like God was calling me to something bigger, especially to be able to help our veterans. And during my tenure at the school, I planned the Veterans Day assemblies. So that's how I got to know their stories and their struggles and really connect with them. And then, like I said before, I tried to find an organization where I could volunteer and I couldn't find anything. So I had a Marine friend of mine who's in business development, and he said, well, why don't you start your own thing? And that was kind of the spark that led to that. So I took a leap of faith, left the school behind, my 17-year career in education behind, and just decided to do this. And I'll tell you what, it's been one wild, crazy, beautiful ride. I'm so glad that I did take that leap of faith. And when I was at the school, I would always tell my students, or I'd have them watch the movie, It's a Wonderful Life. And I would tell them, you know, take yourself out. You were never born. Whose life didn't you touch? And I often think about, if Roots for Boots wasn't here, you know, what veteran is sitting without a track chair, still confined to his home or her home? You know, who? We also run a monthly food bank. We started with 8 veterans over 2 years ago. We're now up to over 90. You know, where would all these people be? And it just breaks my heart that when I was in the school teaching, surrounding my area there were these veterans that I didn't know needed all this help. And it's been such a gift for us to be able to provide that assistance.
Why veterans? Why were you passionate about helping veterans?
Well, I come from a military family. My great-grandfather was in World War I. My grandfather was in World War II. My father's a former Marine. My uncle's in the Navy. My father-in-law was in the Korean War. And I just love America because it's the land of opportunity, and a lot of blood was spilled in the sand for the freedoms that we enjoy as Americans. And I used to tell my kids all the time, don't ever forget that. You know, your freedom comes at a price. And again, when I was at the school, and I heard the stories and struggles of our veterans, whether it was a Gulf War veteran or a Vietnam veteran, you know, I felt like I had the ability to help. Little did I know how much. Well, and I have a great team. I always say, you know, it's not just me. I have a great team that helps me.
Is your team paid, or are you all volunteers?
No, nobody's paid, including me. We're all volunteers.
We're all volunteers. You know, the points that you bring up about the veterans, I mean, there are certain aspects of some of the challenges that veterans face that we hear about more often. For example, homelessness of veterans, those who have had problems getting jobs or keeping jobs, those who have suffered from PTSD. Why do you think those things occur? Why don't those veterans get the kind of help that they need?
I don't know that I have the answer to that, but I can tell you that in our area, and especially in the York Adams area where I am here, we formed a massive network between the nonprofits and anybody and everyone who can possibly do something for a veteran. And through that network, we have been able to just accomplish phenomenal things. And I think a lot of it is, there's a lot of things out there, but a lot of it's just not connected. And that's kind of how we were down here, where there was nonprofits popping up, doing this, doing that. And there were other organizations, veterans organizations, and we didn't know what each other was doing. And then when we were finally able to connect, we made this just amazing network. And it also prevented the overlap from veterans taking from this nonprofit and that nonprofit. You know, it kind of closed that loophole. So I just think there's just a lot of agencies and nonprofits out there that aren't connected together and don't know what everybody's doing. I think that's part of it.
Have you seen a bigger call for services or needs for services during the pandemic?
I think for the area where we operate, the biggest thing, and I was listening to your guest earlier, and he mentioned the term social void. And I think that that's been the hardest thing for our veterans, because the monthly food bank that we run, they really look forward to that, because we had lunch inside. So you would see a Gulf War vet sitting with a World War II vet, with a Vietnam vet, and they're just sitting there having a great time sharing stories. And that was taken away, and we had to go to a drive-through. So we did our best, you know, to reach out to them. But I think that loneliness was probably the worst part for them. Now it's getting better. It's getting better. As far as the needs, I don't think the needs really increased. It was just the loneliness that I saw.
Well, we're almost out of time, Ona. Thank you very much for being with us today and the work that you're doing. For those who may want to support Roots for Boots, how can they do that?
Well, you can go to our website. It's www.rootsforboots.com, just rootsforboots.com. All of my contact information is on there. And also, if you click on our news and events tab, I do have a monthly newsletter that you can sign up for, so you can see what we're up to. If you're interested in volunteering for anything piques your interest there, just reach out to us. But all the information's there, our events and all that.
What kind of volunteers do you need?
Well, we use volunteers predominantly at our monthly food bank. And that's the second Tuesday of every month. Just contact me before you come, so I don't have too many volunteers for that.
That'd be a good problem to have, maybe. But Christy Lucas, CEO. CEO for Roots for Boots. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
I'm Scott Lamar. Have yourself a great weekend.